This social distancing after inoculation is still important. The United States reported more than 114,000 new cases of coronavirus yesterday, along with over 3,500 deaths. Globally, more than 456,000 new cases were counted yesterday, with just under 15,000 new deaths. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 36 degrees and overcast. In New York City, 34 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Once again, you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. It's 12 noon. Coming up next, The Gary Null Show.
Everyone, I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, looking back at Syria, the White Helmets, and what is happening now. How much of the official narrative coming from the State Department, the White House, the major media, even the alternative media, like Democracy Now, how much of it was accurate? How much of it was, let's simply put a positive face on it, they were believing that something was real when, in fact, had they done their homework, it was not. My guest to unpack all this is Vanessa Bealey. Vanessa is a British investigative journalist, a photographer, and she focuses on the conflicts in the Middle East, particularly in Syria, Gaza, and Palestine, Iraq, Egypt, and Yemen. She's an associate editor of 21st Century Wire, and was a member of a peace-finding mission to Syria organized by the U.S. Peace Council. She's a contributing writer for the Global Campaign to Return to Palestine, The Dissident Voice, and manages the website The Wall Will Fall, where she blogs about her travels and reports from the Middle East. Vanessa's articles appear in Mint Press, News, Russia Today, Last American Vagabond, 21st Century Wire, and others. She was a finalist for the prestigious Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, which has previously been awarded to Robert Perry, Patrick Coburn, Robert Fisk, and others. Last year, she received the Serena Shim Award for Uncompromising Integrity in Journalism. Her website is thewallwillfall.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's really good to be back on.
It has been a while since you have been on the program. With the COVID pandemic and street protests and the most vicious election perhaps in U.S. history upon us, the conversation of Syria, the occupied territories, and other Middle Eastern countries where the U.S. has been involved in regime change has taken not just a backseat in the bus, it's invisible. Now that you're back in Damascus, share some of the updates on conditions in Syria and the most recent efforts by the United States and its coalition forces to oust Assad. That's continuing. What is the current state of rebel forces such as al-Nusra? And put this into the larger context for those who are new listeners, and we have a lot of new listeners, who may not know anything about an alternative view and reality of what occurred in Syria. The official narrative would have it that Assad, following his father's predilection, started to clamp down on any dissent in Syria. The people were starving. He imprisoned people and then began to fire on his own people. That's part of the official narrative, which justified, in the minds of the British and the Americans and others, to go in there and save the people, very similar to what we did in Libya, for example, in other countries historically. And yet, unlike any of the reporters who do not parse their words on CNBC and CNN and the New York Times, you were in Syria. You were in these countries. You met with officials. You met with citizens. And from what I am knowledgeable about, at least, that we have learned from the past from you, you were not censored, meaning they did not take you to where they wanted you to speak with someone. You chose the people you wanted to speak to and where you could go so you could see for yourself the truth. So what was the actual occurrences? What actually precipitated this need for regime change? And it came very close to succeeding. And what role did ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda play in being supported by the allies? Saudi Arabia, for example, Turkey, and other countries, the United States and Great Britain, in helping to either give information, weapons, funding, training, or sanctuary to these terrorists. Now, that's a real contradiction. We have a war on terror, and yet we're supporting terrorists. But then we decide to call them the moderate people, as if there's a moderate terrorist. So this is where we want to start our journey to clarify what was wrong with the official version to begin with. Take your time, please. The form is yours.
Thank you very much. I'll try and condense at least 20 years history into a shorter time. But you mentioned the war on terror, and so that's where I'll start with the event of 9/11 that precipitated the so-called war on terror. Of course, if we actually look at global terrorism since 9/11, it has grown exponentially for reasons that I'll explain while I'm unpacking the Syria story. Now, if we go back to 2001 to 2003, the communications between Tony Blair and Bush during the lead up to the second war against Iraq, based on, of course, the dodgy dossier of the weapons of mass destruction. We see, and those emails are encapsulated in the Chilcot report, which retrospectively, of course, investigated the fraud of the weapons of mass destruction. Now, those communications talk very clearly about the fact that they want to try and develop a different kind of relationship with Syria to avoid having to intervene militarily or, as we see now, by proxy. Going forward, of course, as I said, I'll try to condense, but I'll try to lead up to what happened in 2011. In 2003, of course, there was a meeting in Tel Aviv, including Condoleezza Rice, where they talked about the new Middle East. And that also included, of course, the partitioning of Syria, etc., into secular statelets. If we then go forward to 2009, we were told in 2013 by Roland Dumas, a former French foreign minister, that in 2009 he was approached by members of British intelligence and British government at that time to let him know that they were effectively going to be funding militant groups inside Syria to overthrow the Syrian government. Now, we then also, of course, have Operation CIA, Operation Timber Sycamore, which was the training and equipping of, as you said, the so-called moderates by President Obama. Of course, the majority of those weapons mysteriously fell into the hands of groups like ISIS and al-Qaeda. And then at the beginning of 2011, we had these externally fomented and armed protests. Of course, at the time, the media suppressed any information about the marches that were far larger in volume, that were coming out onto the streets in support of President Bashar al-Assad. And actually, there is an article that was written in 2012 by Jonathan Steele, then for The Guardian, where he states that the one point that the media is avoiding is the fact that Bashar al-Assad has enormous popularity inside Syria. And actually, that popularity has lasted until today. 85% of Syrian territory is now back under the control of the Syrian government. We have elections this year, actually, in Syria. Just to let your listeners know, your audience know, I've been living in Damascus since October 2019. So I'm actually living through events here. Prior to that, of course, I was coming every 2 or 3 months and reporting on and witnessing and photographing many of the liberation campaigns by the Syrian Arab Army and allies to free areas of Syria, vast areas of Syria, from the occupation of groups linked to Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and funded, financed, armed, and equipped by the US coalition, which of course includes the UK, the US, the Gulf states. If we go back to 2014, of course, Joe Biden actually let slip that ISIS was and other groups were being funded by American allies, which included Turkey and Jordan and the Gulf states. Now, of course, what he omitted from that admission was the fact that these states would not be funding terrorist armed groups invading and occupying areas of Syria without it being endorsed and sanctioned by the United States. There is a huge amount of documentation now linking the US to the creation of ISIS, the fact that it morphed out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq originally, which of course was also backed and supported by the US. And more recently, we've had instances where it is being documented that the US is effectively transporting ISIS from Syria into Iraq. They are training them there, equipping them, and then sending them back into Syria, where, of course, for some time they were occupying the oil-rich area of the northeast, which is now under the control of both the U.S. coalition occupation forces and another of the U.S. proxies, the Kurdish Contras, the Syria Democratic Forces, that are now profiting, of course, from Syria's oil resources in the northeast. In fact, under Trump, the company Delta Energy was allowed to take over the trading of Syrian oil in collaboration with the Kurdish Contras, the SDF. That oil is being siphoned out of Syria in American transport via the Al-Walid crossing, which is close to the illegal American base, military base, in El Tanf, which is on the border with Iraq and Jordan. Now, in El Tanf, there is a 55-kilometer exclusion zone around the American military base. And within that exclusion zone, the U.S. is effectively training the armed groups, which include Al-Qaeda affiliates and ISIS affiliates. They have imported HIMARS equipment, artillery equipment, into that exclusion zone. So those are high mobility artillery units that have a maximum range of around 300 kilometers. So there is potential of them being able to target even the outskirts of Damascus from Al-Tanf itself. They have been used to target Syrian Arab Army bases and even Russian convoys in the northeast and to the east of the Euphrates. So effectively, we have a situation now in Syria where, of course, we're under extreme economic sanctions. Those were brought in under Trump, under the CESA law last year. And effectively, Syria is under blockade. The COVID-19 crisis has been used to close borders here, although, of course, borders are not closed to the movement of American troops. And Syria, as all countries that are put under sanctions by the U.S. and its allies, the people here are suffering. The oil, as I said, is occupied, not necessarily because the U.S. needs the oil, but they use it as revenue for their proxies that are occupying Syrian territory. And they also use the occupation of those resources to prevent the Syrian people from receiving their own resources, which means that, of course, We have massive electricity outages. In most rural areas, people are only getting 1 or 2 hours a day of electricity. There is very little fuel. There's very little heating fuel or gas. So in the two coldest months of the year, people are really suffering here. There's, of course, enforced inflation. Wheat and barley crops were burned throughout most of last year. So there are bread shortages. Wheat and barley is also being traded by the Kurdish contras across the border into Iraq, again, to prevent the Syrian people from receiving those agricultural resources. So the situation here is economically very, very difficult. And of course, we now have an incoming Joe Biden throwback party to the Obama-Clinton era. And already we're seeing signs of an uptick in military aggression against Syria.
Just examples of that, please.
Well, since New Year's Eve, we've had a number of attacks by ISIS. And of course, I reiterate that ISIS is fundamentally under the control of the US coalition. But there have been a series of attacks on Syrian Arab Army convoys since New Year's Eve and since Joe Biden's inauguration, a huge number of martyrs. And of course, what it's done, the main Deir ez-Zor road going from Deir ez-Zor to Homs and then down to Damascus is a main arterial road. So what this does is, of course, it creates the insecurity, what little oil that is allowed into areas of Syria under control of the government are now being impeded by the attacks on that particular road. There have also been attacks on, or suspected terrorist attacks on, fuel depots, fuel convoys elsewhere in Syria. There has been an increase in Israeli attacks. Only a few days ago, I visited an area to the northwest of Damascus that was targeted by Israel. It destroyed 4 homes. It killed a family of 5. 1 baby was pulled out of the rubble, taken to hospital, and she later died from her injuries. And we've seen an increase in the attacks or the aggression by Israel against Syrian territory since, again, New Year's Eve. But the latest attack, which attacked multiple areas of Syria, came, I think, 1 or 2 days after Biden's inauguration.
Less than a year ago, the former British intelligence officer, James Lemessurier, who was the founder of the faux humanitarian organization, the White Helmets, died suddenly from a fall off of his flat's balcony in Istanbul. I remember that his death was being reported as suspicious, yet this organization that is supposed to have been made up volunteers has been glorified in the American British media, even have a film about them winning an Academy Award, a short documentary. But the media has completely ignored any real investigations into the controversies about the White Helmets, particularly your own. And rather than the media, and now even British authorities, which means the BBC, are targeting you as an accomplice of the Syrian government. We have not heard about their ongoing activities in a couple of years. However, I read everything that was on the website, noticed they are stepping up their activities again and seemingly in providing assistance in the context of COVID scare in Syria. First of all, what can you tell us about the White Helmets' current activities and their connections with terrorist organizations? And how much support do they have from the Syrian people, which I could not imagine as much of the population because the White Helmets are deeply connected with the Islamic extremist groups, and therefore their Wahhabi-like ideology, by extension as well, is connected. So tell us about that. Then, after that, I read all of your communication that you had posted concerning your talk with a top producer, the BBC, and how she was goading you into being interviewed, supposedly be objective, but in the end, there was nothing objective She was setting you up. I thought it was just one of the worst cases of media bias and manipulation I've ever seen. But then again, it's the BBC. That's like saying, well, I'm shocked that CNN, you know, is stealing the truth. Really? So tell us about your confrontation with the BBC, and then tell us about the White Helmets and what the American media still is glorifying them. And remember, it was Democracy Now! That, you know, did a whole program on them, and they were also supporting that regime change. And that's part of the so-called left media, the same left media, unfortunately, that today has deplatformed Chris Hedges and Glenn Greenwald, John Pilger, and some of the finest names in broadcasting and investigative reporting. You won't find him any longer ever appearing. Matt Taibbi, you won't see him on CNN or MSNBC as you used to, because they are talking about the truth, and what the current power elite want is official positions. So our official position is White Helmets are good, and Vanessa Bealey or others like her are part of a, you know, disinformation campaign. Take your time, please. It's an opportunity to share with millions of people the truth.
Well, the BBC contacted me, and of course, I think we should probably put this into some context. The White Helmets were established effectively by a former British military intelligence officer working for an organization called Analysis, Research and Knowledge. Now, there has been a recent leak of UK Foreign Office documents which expose the extent to which British intelligence and the British Foreign Office was involved from the outset of the regime change war waged against Syria to effectively provide public relations and media support for armed groups, including those affiliated to Al-Qaeda and ISIS, committing terrible atrocities against the Syrian people in the areas that they invaded and occupied and incarcerated the people in prior to liberation by the Syrian Arab Army and their allies. There is a huge amount of detail on those documents in an article by Grey Zone. If people want to go and check that out, it's well worth reading, because it's shocking the amount of resources that were poured into whitewashing these groups, lionizing them in the, you know, in public perception in the West. And of course, you know, that perception is picked up also in US media just as much as it is in EU and global media that is aligned with the US coalition in Syria. So the White Helmets were brought in around 2013, I believe, because the media itself was starting to flounder. It was starting to be exposed. And so they needed to bring in groups that would provide plausible deniability, both for the media and for the governments that were effectively orchestrating the war against the Syrian people and the Syrian government. The White Helmets were brought in to, and this is actually stated in British government documents, strategy documents. It was brought in to corroborate the evidence, effectively, that the British government needed to carry out its foreign policy in Syria, which was regime change. Now, of course, we had the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And in Syria, we have the chemical weapon attacks. Now, the White Helmets have been instrumental in the production of stage scenes and the provision of witnesses for these chemical attack allegations against the Syrian government, despite the fact, of course, that the Syrian government in 2013 worked with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, to destroy all of its chemical weapon capability and stores under the supervision of Russia. And if we fast forward very quickly to Douma 2018, when I was actually in Damascus during the final liberation of the eastern suburbs of Damascus, there was an alleged chemical attack in Douma in April 2018. And of course, that entire production was emanating from the White Helmets and the armed groups that were in control of Douma, namely Jaish al-Islam, which was an Islamic group that carried out a huge number of atrocities against Syrian civilians, including the caging of civilians in Douma itself and the use of those human beings inside cages as human shields, and a number of terrible atrocities from 2013 onwards until the liberation of that area. Now, fast forward again. Since then, of course, we've had the exposure of the OPCW report on the Douma attack as fraudulent and compromised, effectively, retrospectively justifying the US, UK and French aggression against Syria, and in particular Damascus. Damascus was bombed shortly after the chemical attack, before the OPCW inspectors had even gone in to verify whether chemical weapons had been used or not. Now, a number of experts that were in the original investigative team for the OPCW came forward to give evidence at the Courage Foundation, and that evidence was also passed to WikiLeaks, that the final report from the OPCW had deliberately omitted their conclusions that neither chlorine nor sarin had been used in that attack. You know, this is a crucial point in history, in fact, because effectively, what it does is it exposes the White Helmets as having fraudulently produced scenes, provided witnesses to corroborate evidence for these alleged chemical weapon attacks that are used to criminalize the Syrian government and to justify continued military aggression, both direct and by proxy, against Syria. And what we have to remember is that the OPCW is a global body. In other words, and it's now also been given the mandate to attribute blame. So this is a very, very important precedent that's being set here, that this evidence from former OPCW inspectors should be allowed to be heard. And of course, what is now happening is that the members of the UN Security Council, who have a vested interest in regime change in Syria, are blocking any such airing of the concerns of those former inspectors within the OPCW. So this is a very important context to the OPCW, sorry, to the BBC smear campaign that was then waged after the death of James Le Mesurier in, as you said, November 2019. Now, not only had Mesurier been implicated in fraud, in other words, embezzling funds that were coming into the NGO Mayday Rescue that had been established to siphon the financing of the White Helmets from the British government in particular to the White Helmets inside the Al-Qaeda-controlled areas of Syria, which is now only in Idlib, to the northwest of Syria. But he'd also been exposed as having provided witnesses from among the White Helmets to corroborate, as I said, the fraudulent narrative of a chemical attack in Douma. So he was under considerable pressure at the time that he allegedly took his life. There are questions, of course, over his death, despite the official narrative. If we then come forward, the BBC informed us, I think, around 6 months later that they were going to be doing a program called Mayday. They were going to be looking at the history and the life and the death of James Le Mesurier. And they contacted myself. They contacted members of the academic working group that was instrumental in bringing forward the evidence against the OPCW regarding the Douma chemical attack, and against a number of others, like Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria in 2003 to 2006. Now, from the outset, it was clear, as you said, that this was really nothing more than another very similar smear attack to previous in The Guardian, The Times, Huffington Post, etc. And so I had a series of conversations with Chloe Hadjimatiou, the producer, and in the end I declined to take part in the interview because I could see where it was heading. And of course, the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. I think it's around 15 hours of program, in which were included the very people that had established the White Helmets. There was testimony from those that were instrumental in sustaining the war against Syria, providing media support for the armed groups. So it was very much a sort of a UK Foreign Office intelligence propaganda loop controlled by the BBC, unsurprisingly for many. Much of the information that was put out was inaccurate or certainly biased. And for example, I think in one of the episodes, I think it was the one where they claimed that I had met Sean Penn, which was inaccurate. I had never met him. It was Eva Bartlett that actually met him. Now, in that program, they used a researcher, Abdul Qadir Habak. Now, Habak had been filmed working very closely with an armed group called Nour al-Din Zinki. Nour al-Din Zinki in 2016, or members of the group, had beheaded a 12-year-old boy in Aleppo and filmed themselves doing so. So they'd carried out the public execution and torture of a 12-year-old child. And the researcher, and he was also used as a witness in one episode of the BBC, was therefore working very closely with armed groups that were funded. Nour al-Din Zinki was funded by the US. Of course, they dropped the funding after the footage of the beheading of the child was released. So the BBC have a number of issues to answer here. I mean, not only the fact that James Le Mesurier's wife, Emma Winberg, who was instrumental to the production of the program, she herself had co-founded a company called IncoStrat with another former military officer, Paul Tilley, both of whom, of course, were friends of James Le Mesurier. IncoStrat was paid by the British Foreign Office to provide witnesses, for example, for BBC programs. So in other words, to plant witnesses into BBC reports to provide the narrative or provide evidence for the narratives that the BBC were producing themselves. She was also responsible for the PR and media support for Jaish al-Islam, the group that I mentioned that was controlling Douma. Now, none of this conflict of interest was mentioned in the BBC program. So effectively, what we're now doing is preparing a series of reports to be sent to Ofcom, detailing the conflict of interest on a number of issues. Not only, of course, the fact that Habak, the researcher that I mentioned, was trained by British Foreign Office outreach agents inside Syria. So effectively, he was working for the British Foreign Office. And again, none of these connections were mentioned. And so therefore, the BBC has effectively, as you said, carried out a complete cover-up of James Le Mesurier's role in the creation of the White Helmets, the role of the White Helmets themselves, and their affiliation to the armed groups and their participation in the production of propaganda that has sustained the war and enabled savage sanctions against the Syrian people. And not only that, but, the White Helmets stand accused of crimes such as organ trafficking, child abduction by Syrian civilians. This is not something that I'm creating out of midair. There have been major investigations done, and Syrian civilians accuse them of child abduction, of taking children to the border with Turkey, and the children's bodies return with organs missing. Now, in any normal circumstances, the British Foreign Office, the UN should be calling for an independent inquiry. Of course, this has not happened because the White Helmets are so heavily politicized. The countries that are involved in the destabilization of Syria have invested millions into this organization to protect their interests. And their interests, of course, is the destabilization of Syria and the removal of the Syrian government. And the White Helmets are key to that. So they're not going to allow this edifice to crumble. They're not going to allow this facade to fall. And therefore, we have organizations like the BBC coming forward to protect them in public view, of course. Although I would say, actually, especially in the UK, the public consensus is very much swinging against the BBC generally, not only in Syria, but regarding their narrative on COVID-19.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We're looking back at Syria, the White Helmets, and what is happening now. In Syria, talking with us is Vanessa Beely, B-E-E-L-E-Y. And you may have some insight into this or not. Several years ago, I was sent a video, and the video showed a camera being set up in a building looking out a window, and it was very specific that they had to focus it out a window. Now, being a film director myself of over 100 documentaries, I know when something, a shot is being set up to grab a particular moment. It might be a sunset or something else. But in this case, it was out towards another building in the distance, maybe a quarter mile away. And then they leave. Then they come back. And then they get ready for a shot, and then suddenly there's an explosion, and you see all this dust and debris going in the air, and they're filming this, and then they film it up close. So obviously they had a two-camera setup, one from a building getting a long shot and another up close, and this was then reported on American media as the battle in Syria. Then another person, you can see them talking about what they're doing, as if they're the only ones that will ever see this footage. But then there's another citizen showing that this was simply hundreds of Syrian civilians going down and collecting fuel, oil, from a tanker that was draining in, and someone had set that on fire and created an explosion. So they created a scene. They set up a scene that did not exist in reality. There was no terrorist attack. This was not a war, you know, zone attack. It was simply someone taking a fuel tank and rupturing it, and it would all went into this ditch, and these people were running out to get this, and they faked it. Then someone sent me a series of photographs of four different White Helmet rescues of children who had been victims of chemical weapons, and you see circled the same little guy and the same little girl in all of them. And that was staged. You can't have the child in one, then be in three different ones. And I'm thinking, surely someone in the American media will see this, that this is propaganda, this is staged. And yet not a single word in the American media. They continue to use that footage as if it were real. Your thoughts on how much of what we were exposed to in the United States by the media was actually fake news and staged for the benefit of giving the White Helmets and the White Helmets a good perspective and the Syrian government a bad perspective on this event.
Yeah, that report you're talking about was actually in Homs. That was our Damon, CNN, who, of course, after the Duma chemical attack, was seen in Idlib sniffing backpacks, if you remember, and swearing that she could smell chemical weapons on the backpacks of the people that had been bussed out of eastern Ghouta into Idlib. Actually, I made a documentary called The Veto. It's available on my YouTube channel with a Syrian documentary maker, actually looking at the early footage or media reports leading up to around 2013, as I said, when the White Helmets were brought in. originally, when the media started to produce their reports criminalizing the Syrian government, effectively a, how can I describe it? A media platform had been established for all of the opposition citizen journalists or embeds, foreign journalists that had been embedded with those armed groups in order to produce the reports. They all fed their various news reports into this platform. And then organizations like CNN, the BBC, Al Jazeera, Al Arabi would go to this platform and take, but what they would do is only take the section that was suitable for their breaking news section. And of course, what they didn't include was, as you've quite rightly pointed out, the bit before and the bit after. The bit before was when they were preparing people and rehearsing them in their lines. The bit that you saw on CNN was, let's say, when they go live and camera action. And then the end bit, where they're laughing and congratulating themselves on having, you know, fooled the people in the West, on CNN and on various other channels. And in the film, The Vita, what we've actually done is to take those outtakes and to show you the CNN report or the, Channel 4 report and to show them how it was manufactured. It's absolutely mind-blowing. The majority of the reports that you were getting from 2011 up to 2013 were faked. I can say that quite safely because I've watched hours and hours and hours of before and after footage and what was actually put out by CNN. And the CNN report on the burning pipeline, as you quite rightly said, was quite extraordinary. I mean, I think this was actually a documentary. This was I'm trying to remember the name of the documentary, but it was a major landmark in the narrative production against the Syrian government. Extraordinary. And I think I've sort of forgotten where I was going with the rest of the question. Can you just remind me?
You've explained this. These were setups, but they were not just set up. They were picked up and played and have continued to be false material about the benefits to American efforts to help the Syrian people with white helmets. And that's why Hollywood embraced them and even people on the left in media like Democracy Now! Embraced them. You did a critical look. Now, you weren't the only one. You have Seymour Hersh, who showed that the Syrian gas attacks, several, were false. These were by the rebels, not by the Syrian government. And several of those have been shown to be by rebel forces and then purported to be by Syria. Do you know of any actual cases where the Syrian government, Assad, authorized the use of the chemical weapons against his own people? Do you have any evidence? And if so, would you share it with us? And if not, what can you share that could show, like, the gray zone and Max Blumenthal and Seymour Hersh and others, that these were actually done by the United States-supported terrorist groups?
Well, I mean, no, I don't have any evidence of the Syrian government using chemical weapons. And as I've said, in their chemical weapons, what little they had were destroyed. And that has all been documented and archived by the OPCW, who oversaw the destruction of the chemical weapons in 2013, 2014. Now, what we have to remember in 2013, when there was allegedly the attack in Eastern Ghouta, which was the first, as I call, dodgy dossier to enable or to ramp up military aggression, direct and by proxy, against Syria, under the humanitarian pretext, which, of course, is very similar to what we saw in Iraq under the weapons of mass destruction, dodgy dossier. but actually, in early 2013, in Khan al-Asl, which was an area close to Aleppo, there was a chemical attack against Syrian Arab Army and civilians by terrorist groups. Now, it took the UN 6 months, despite repeated requests from the permanent Syrian representative to the UN, It took them 6 months to come to Damascus. And surprise, surprise, the day they landed at Damascus to investigate a terrorist chemical attack, there was an alleged chemical attack in eastern Ghouta by the Syrian government. Now, as you say, there's a huge amount of evidence now mounting up against the Ghouta attack being the Syrian government, against the Khan Shihun attack being the Syrian government. And, of course, Khan Shihun was, again, the White Helmets were instrumental in providing testimony, evidence, samples from that alleged attack. And, of course, that precipitated another unlawful aggression by President Trump before an investigation had been carried out. I mean, you know, we're seeing a familiar pattern here. And myself, speaking myself, I mean, I remember in, I think it was early 2019, I was on the border between Hama and Idlib in a Syrian Christian town, Al-Skelbiye, which had been effectively surrounded by terrorist groups for more than 6 years that regularly targeted schools, children's areas, homes, civilian infrastructure, etc. during that time. And one evening when I was there, news came in of a let's say a low-grade chemical attack by Al-Qaeda affiliates to villages just to the north of us. And I think around 30 victims were brought into the local hospital, all of them suffering from difficulty breathing, skin lesions. Some had sort of anaphylactic shock. And there were descriptions of mortality in some of the suburbs of Western Aleppo. So I myself have witnessed incoming attacks using low-grade chemical mixes, let's say, in the mortars or in the grenades or in the rockets. And, of course, when you're talking about CNN, just before the Douma attack, this is an interesting anecdote, I had actually gone on a tour of the liberated areas with Frederick Bleichen of CNN. And together we had visited a number of facilities used by the terrorist groups to produce what looked like chemical weapons. They had manuals showing them how to produce grenades with chlorine in them, for example. They had containers. Some of it was organophosphate, which is used to make explosives, etc. But there were definitely laboratories and ammunition factories that we visited. Now, the day after we made that visit, there was the alleged attack in Douma, and Pleitgen went live on CNN. He talked about the fact that it was very possible it was the Syrian government that had carried out the attack, but he failed to mention all of the laboratories and warehouses that we'd seen that had been under the control of the armed groups in the liberated areas. So, you know, just a very personal example of how mainstream media, if it's not lying directly, it's lying by omission. And that has been the pattern of this 10-year war against the Syrian people.
One aside, you may or may not be familiar with this, but we had a big to-do about Hillary Clinton and the State Department not rescuing the survivors of the attack on the Benghazi mission. And no one, either from the State Department or Hillary Clinton or from any agency or any member of Congress, and certainly none from the intelligence agencies or the oversight agencies, had anything to say about this. You know, that they couldn't get there any sooner. I think it was 13 hours or something. And yet evidence was later presented, but not under oath, that they could have had soldiers there, they could have been rescued, and I was given information that was because the Benghazi mission was being used as a place that would take Gaddafi's weapons and get them into the hands of different rebel groups in Turkey and then into Syria and also into Syria. And, of course, that would breach a lot of international laws, And so everyone just decided not to talk about it because that would have come out. Are you familiar with what actually occurred or anything that you could add to that scenario?
No, only that, I mean, obviously we know that not only weapons, but terrorists came in from Libya. And of course, you know, now we're seeing them percolating back. Turkey is basically taking terrorist groups that are, let's say, under the protectorate of Turkey and sending them to Libya to fight. So, you know, at the same time, of course, at the beginning of the conflict in Syria, I think it was Ali Hashem that resigned from Al Jazeera because he was reporting on the weapons and militants that were coming in from Jordan and flooding into southern Syria. So, you know, all that I'm aware of is that, of course, weapons and manpower from Libya were being transferred into Syria as they were from Iraq and from Jordan.
In Syria and Damascus, what's Damascus like? Have they been able to recover any of the architecture or the infrastructure of the places that were destroyed during this long protracted military effort?
I think the easiest way to describe to people is that what the terrorists did is that they dug into the suburbs of the cities that they were targeting. So in Aleppo and in Damascus, the same. They dug into suburbs, not into city center. Although, of course, here in Damascus, I've forgotten now the figures of the huge number of tens of thousands of mortars that came into city center and injured Syrian civilians, killed Syrian civilians over the years that the eastern suburbs were occupied. Look, you know, rebuilding and restoration is going on, particularly of essential civilian infrastructure, but of course it's being impeded under the Trump administration, although some people argue that, you know, Trump didn't start any new wars, but effectively what he did, he provided the economic sledgehammer, the economic misery for the people of Syria at a time when militarily they were seriously gaining ground. You know, Russia had come into the war in September 2015. By 2016 or the end of 2016, Aleppo was liberated. The Syrian army was really surging to victory and the terrorists were being driven out of all of the enclaves that they had occupied prior, to 2016. And then Trump came in. And of course, at that point, America was facing, let's say, the military defeat of its project to destabilize Syria. And so at that point, I believe the focus turned to economic warfare, which, of course, to a huge degree is even more insidious than military warfare, in my opinion. And under Trump, we've seen a massive increase in sanctions, in blockade, in siege. Any humanitarian aid is only and exclusively coming into terrorist-held areas, namely the northwest into Idlib. And, of course, that is further aid and equipment for al-Qaeda under the guise of humanitarian aid. The ambassador, Kelly Clark, visited the Bab al-Hawa crossing. Now, Bab al-Hawa, she named it as one of the most essential humanitarian cross-border entrances for humanitarian aid. In fact, what it is an al-Qaeda trading post. So everything that comes into Bab al-Hawa is being used to provide revenue for al-Qaeda. You know, the hypocrisy of the U.S. administration and how it portrays its role in its lexicon supporting the Syrian people, while in reality, the only aid that's coming in is going to al-Qaeda and affiliates. The military occupation is now increasing. We're seeing more military hardware and convoys entering illegally from Iraq into the northeast. And meanwhile, the areas under the Syrian government control are under sanctions, under blockade, and therefore rebuilding, restoration, repair of civilian infrastructure is very difficult.
So final question for you, because we're running up to the end of our time here. Have you met personally with Assad or his wife?
No. I met President Assad in 2016 with the U.S. peace delegation.
Okay. What's your impression?
I met someone very intelligent. Of course, he was UK educated, both. In fact, his wife was born in the UK, educated in the UK, and worked in the UK until they both, rather unexpectedly, because his older brother was killed in a car crash. And so Bashar al-Assad had to relinquish his career as a eye doctor, an ophthalmologist, and return to Syria. Somebody with vision, enormous humility, great intelligence, and someone who, you know, whatever you think of him, Peter Ford always described him as a reformist when Peter Ford was ambassador here in Syria leading up from 2003 to 2006.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The Senate confirmed two of Biden's top cabinet nominees yesterday, Alejandro Mayorkas as Homeland Security Secretary and Pete Buttigieg as Transportation Secretary. Mayorkas served in the Obama administration as both the Homeland Security Deputy Secretary and the Director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and is the first Latinx and immigrant person to lead DHS. Buttigieg, former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and a 2020 Democratic presidential candidate, is the first Senate-confirmed LGBTQ cabinet secretary. Prior to Tuesday, only four of Biden's cabinet nominees have been confirmed by the Senate amid GOP efforts to stall the process. Those confirmed are Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, and National Intelligence Director Avril Haines. Lawyers for Donald Trump are expected to argue two key points during the Senate impeachment trial beginning next week. First, that impeaching a private citizen no longer in public office is unconstitutional. And second, that Trump's false claims about electoral fraud and his speech before the January 6th riot are protected by the First Amendment. House Democratic impeachment managers filed a brief yesterday morning accusing Trump of whipping his supporters into a frenzy on January 6th and describing Trump as singularly responsible for the riot that ensued. The nine impeachment managers argue that Trump's speech is not protected by the First Amendment, which was never intended, they wrote, to allow a president to, quote, provoke lawless action if he loses at the polls. The Democrats' brief also argues against a so-called January exception that would allow public officials to escape impeachment by leaving office. Quote, a president must answer comprehensively for his conduct in office from his first day in office through his last, the impeachment managers said. More than 370 Democratic congressional aides have signed on to an open letter appealing to senators to convict Trump for inciting a violent attack on our workplace that threatened the peaceful transition of power and left one of their co-workers dead. The appeal lays out, through firsthand accounts, how many of its signatories had sheltered under desks, barricaded themselves in offices, or watched on TV as their own bosses and colleagues fled for their lives. Quote, as congressional employees, we don't have a vote on whether to convict Donald J. Trump for his role in inciting the violent attack at the Capitol, but our senators do. And for our sake, and the sake of the country, we ask that they vote to convict the former president and bar him from ever holding office again. End quote. The Washington area's two largest counties are struggling with inequities in coronavirus vaccine distribution as they continue to receive fewer doses than needed to inoculate eligible seniors and workers. In Montgomery County, Maryland, residents in wealthier areas like Bethesda and Chevy Chase are overrepresented in inoculation signups, while residents in Gaithersburg and Silver Spring are underrepresented. In Fairfax County, Virginia, officials say elderly Black and Latinx residents have registered for inoculation appointments at disproportionately low rates, either over fear of side effects or because they don't know how to make the appointment. Washington, D.C.